It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Walker's administration says that Wisconsin's contraception coverage law doesn't hold up in light of the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision. Our guest says they're wrong.
First, a lot of people might say that civic participation is important, worthwhile, but fun? Not really. Our next guest says we need to change that in order to get more people involved.
And he says we should turn to the world of game design to get people excited about democracy. Josh Lerner joins us now. He's the executive director of the Participatory Budgeting Project, and his new book is Making Democracy Fun: How Game Design Can Engage Citizens and Transform Politics. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's get into the problem you're trying to solve, a lack of public engagement, mistrust of government. You say one root cause is that for most people, democratic participation is unappealing. How so?
Well, people increasingly don't trust government, and trust in government has declined to around 20%. People are participating less. They're actually downsizing government, calling for less government. And a big part of that is just that we don't believe in government anymore. We don't believe in the value of it. And it's really, for most people, not very enjoyable. So going out to a community meeting, to a public event, a hearing, those are things that aren't at the top of our priority list, and we'd rather do something else with our time. So to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, the problem with democracy is it takes up too many evenings.
And a lot of attention gets focused on the voting and election side of government. You're looking at all that other stuff, the public meetings, the participation. Why is that key?
Well, I think people can participate more than just going to the ballot box every 4 years and checking off a couple names, though we can actually help decide what government does for us. And that's where the missing link that we don't see now in American democracy is that connection between elected officials and people on the ground, where people can really have a direct role in shaping what government does in their communities and the basic services that government provides.
And you were inspired by a tale of two local planning meetings, one in the U.S., one in Venezuela. Can you set the scene in both of those?
Sure. So in the U.S., this was a public hearing for a large new development, Atlantic Yards, in downtown Brooklyn, and a very combative process where you had on one side folks wanting to build a new basketball arena, on the other side people who wanted to preserve the neighborhood. And just the meetings around this were entirely unproductive. People came in, protested for or against one side, and there was really no headway and also no impact in the actual process. And really, the game was rigged in advance, where you had large developers being able to build what they wanted because there wasn't a way for people to have a real say in the process. And, I mean, looking around the room, I just saw people deflated, disappointed, angry. It was a painful meeting. And on the other hand, I was in Venezuela doing some research for a community meeting and saw people laughing, hugging, lingering, having a good time. And I started to ask why. Why is it that in some places we can come out to a meeting and actually enjoy ourselves, and yet other times we just want to leave as quickly as possible?
So why turn to the world of game design for inspiration on how to make those meetings more fun?
Well, games are basically large decision-making processes. You're constantly deciding what to do in a game, and designers have created really sophisticated and effective ways to make those experiences engaging. So to keep people playing games, coming back, and having meaningful experiences. And the deep thought that I've seen game designers put into designing engaging, interactive, fun experiences, I really see them lacking in politics and in a lot of community work. So what I look at in the book is exactly how do designers make engaging experiences, and how can we translate some of those mechanisms and tools and processes into community organizing, politics, and civic engagement.
So you've talked to game designers about how they work their magic. What are a few of the tactics and strategies they use that we could port over into the political world?
Yeah, I did talk to real-life game designers, and they have a lot of valuable lessons. So three of the basic elements that I think are missing from most community engagements that are really critical to games. So having clear rules, artificial conflict, and measurable outcomes. So what does that mean? So clear rules, when you start out a game, you know what the rules are, you know what you can and can't do. And that can be limiting in a sense, but also really can generate a lot of creativity. So if you think about soccer, you know, you can't pick up the ball and run towards the other goal. If you could, it would be a much less interesting game, or maybe be rugby, depending on your opinion of rugby. But it certainly wouldn't be soccer. And so that rule actually enables people to have a good time. Most community meetings, it's not clear what the rules are, what people can and can't do. And then artificial conflict, again, for soccer, you walk onto a field, you're in conflict against their team. But it's artificial in a sense. Once you walk off that field, the conflict isn't quite the same. And we see meetings like the one I described in New York where the conflict is just, it's so intense, and the meeting doesn't have any good way of making that more artificial, of refocusing people's attention, enabling them to work together. And then probably the most critical thing for me is having measurable outcomes so that people know why it matters that they show up to a meeting. Most community meetings, it's not clear what the point is. So what is going to be different in the world afterwards as opposed to before? In a game, you either win, you lose, you get a certain number of points, and that those measurable outcomes are what drives people to participate and links people's participation to real outcomes.
So part of what you're saying, it sounds like it's important to make people feel empowered, to make it feel like their decisions make a difference. We feel that way when we play a well-designed game?
Yes, we do. And if we don't feel empowered, if we don't feel like our decisions make a difference, we stop playing. And that's, I think, what we're seeing in politics and democracy, as people feel like they don't have a say, they're not making a difference, and so they're opting out of the game.
So you spent a lot of time looking at one city in Argentina that made a lot of use of these ideas and really took what you're talking about and did it on a practical level. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The city of Rosario in Argentina, it's around 1 million people. And it's not a lot of great work, but especially in games, they've integrated games into a lot of programs. So I looked at some of them. One was a housing program where residents in some of the poorest neighborhoods would actually decide on new zoning plans and on new housing developments through a game that kind of resembled Tetris, where they would map out who would live on what part of the neighborhood. And looked at some other programs. One was for a children's rights law that was basically enacted in the city through theater workshops, in which city staff would act out how they would actually apply the law, and then through that would develop plans for making it real on the ground. And the city even passed a day of playing games where city employees have to take some time out to play and to play games, and really integrated that throughout the work of local government.
So with, say, that group that designed the layout of their town, it sounds like it's important that the things they do actually have a chance of being implemented. I think the sense a lot of times if you go, like your community meeting you mentioned in Brooklyn, is that it's an opportunity for you to vent about what's going to be a preordained outcome.
Exactly, exactly. And it requires government actually giving people a chance to make a difference and not having things preordained in advance. But we can do that here, too. So one of the programs I look at actually in Canada is participatory budgeting, which is also what I do during my day job and work on here in New York. And just this week, actually, New York City Council announced that it was going to let ordinary people decide to spend $25 million through real meetings, with real competition between groups and between proposals. And that if people came out, they would actually make a concrete difference in their communities, on their parks, their schools, their streets. And that's the kind of thing that's being considered now in some places in Wisconsin as well, and that I think can make a real difference in re-engaging people in democracy.
So we've got that $25 million set there. We're bringing in the public to help allocate it or to set how it's going to be spent. How do we make a game of it?
Well, in a sense, I mean, you can integrate games. You can include them in the meetings. So icebreaker games, everyone here has probably played some kind of team-building game or icebreaker game. Those are great, but actually what I'm interested in more than that is actually redesigning the whole process to be more like a game. So rather than just sprinkling in an icebreaker like it's kind of MSG and makes everything taste better, redesigning the whole experience so that you have those clear rules, so that you have that sense of driving artificial conflict, so that you have real measurable outcomes. And you have all of that actually in participatory budgeting, where there's the budget rules that say what you can and can't do. There's conflict between people because different folks want different things funded, and that's real. But the process makes it a bit more artificial because they're competing against the limits of the system. So you have that $25 million, and you're trying to see together what you can get done within that constraint rather than just duking it out with your neighbors. And then there's really measurable outcomes where you see a certain amount of money, a certain amount of dollars allocated to concrete projects. So whether that's getting new park improvements or improvements to public housing or computers and technology for schools, people see the impact in their community.
And so would you have Team A, Team B, and Team C all try to come up with how to spend this money, or is their team improve the parks versus Team fill potholes?
Yeah, that's actually roughly how it works. So you have teams of people break down into different kind of issue areas. So you have a transportation team or committee and the schools one and the parks one, and they all come up with different projects. They go out and do research. They talk with city experts. They make sure their ideas are doable, and they actually get them approved by the city. And then they put them on a ballot, and they go out and campaign and try and get people to vote for their ideas, and it gets a bit competitive. And then the projects that get the most votes actually get funded and get done.
We're talking to Josh Lerner about getting more people involved in public decision-making by harnessing ideas from the world of game design.
And you can join the show. Do you get involved in local political decisions? Why or why not? What works and what doesn't work at public hearings, planning meetings, and the like? Are you in local government? And do you think these ideas we're talking about could work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Josh Lerner, author of Making Democracy Fun, How Game Design Can Engage Citizens and Transform Politics.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in public hearings or planning meetings as an elected official, a staff person, or a member of the public? Was it an excruciating experience, or did something happen there to make it interesting, make it maybe fun to be civically engaged in decision-making? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Josh, you've seen this kind of thing in action, as you mentioned, in South America. You've done an experiment in Toronto. When people participate in this sort of gamified decision-making, do they enjoy it more? Do they enjoy these public processes more?
Yes, they do, and they participate more, actually, which is really the key indicator. But I think one real important thing to recognize is that fun doesn't necessarily mean that you're sitting there laughing and it's this leisurely activity. Often when we're having fun, when we're enjoying ourselves, it's actually very serious. So if you think about when you're playing a sport or doing something that you really enjoy, often the look on your face actually is very, very focused, and you are in the moment, you are in the flow, and very engaged in the activity. So a lot of these meetings, they don't look like people laughing necessarily. But people are really into the moment, into the activity.
So you might be very serious, you're really into it, but that's better than being bored and or angry.
Yes, and that's actually what makes it afterwards feel like a meaningful experience.
But is that enough? I mean, does the outcome come out better? Do we make better decisions when we have an actively engaged citizenry involved?
Yes, because the challenge is if we don't, then it's a very few people who are deciding. Basically, it's the people who will participate regardless of whether it's meaningful, the kind of usual suspects or the meeting junkies, the folks who have come out to meeting after meeting regardless of what happens. And those people really don't represent the views of most Americans. And so what we see in politics time and time again is that a very narrow kind of extreme fringe gets represented. And that most people are left out because they have better things to do than participate in meetings that don't make a difference and that are not very enjoyable.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff on the line in Burlington. Jeff, hi.
Good evening. How are you, gentlemen?
Good. What do you think about this, Jeff?
Well, I would just like to put in a plug for people to try the experience of becoming involved in their community. 10 years ago, I served on a planning committee for land use plan as a citizen, and that got me interested enough that I ran for supervisor position, and I've been reelected several times. I'm serving my fourth term now, and I'll make just two observations. First of all, the world is run by those who show up, and secondly, if people think that their views would not be appreciated or respected, I respectfully suggest they're wrong. We need as many different viewpoints as possible to get representative government.
Well, Jeff, thank you for calling and sharing your story. And you enjoy this in some way? Again, not like a laughing romp through the park, but you find it enjoyable to engage in this process?
I find it enjoyable on many levels. As a profession, I'm a realtor. So getting to know people who make decisions about land obviously is of interest to me. But beyond that, I can't tell you how many times in the process of researching a question, I've come across some points of view that I'd never thought about. And had I not been doing that research for the public good, I never would have broadened my own knowledge.
Jeff, thank you so much for bringing all that up. Josh, two more elements of the enjoyment. Are these important learning stuff about the world, the local world you live in, one, and the social aspect of getting to know the people in your community and the decision makers in your community?
Very much so, and learning is one of the main elements of games. We're constantly learning how to play better, and that stimulus is what keeps us going. And also, when there are good democratic processes, then there's a key learning moment. So a lot of the experiences I looked at have been called schools of democracy or schools of citizenship, where people are learning the skills necessary to engage as active citizens, like Jeff said. And you can just think about the transformative potential of that. Imagine if there were thousands and thousands more people like Jeff out there who were getting engaged, learning about their community, their neighbors, and figuring out how to make improvements in where they live. So I think we really need more people to be able to do that. But to get more folks out, we need to reach beyond the people who can see those experiences as valuable as they are now, and to reach out to folks who normally would think government is boring and not really worth their time.
When people adopt the ideas you talk about, like participatory budgeting or taking these game-like ideas and putting them into practice, who is it that takes the lead? Who makes it happen?
It's really critical, I think, to have ordinary people in the community playing a lead role. So designing the processes, making key decisions, and having a real say over the matter. And I find time and time again that if you give people real power, they will step up and take responsibility for it and make great decisions. But you also have to give them support for that. So you can't just ask folks to come out to a two-hour meeting and decide how to spend the city budget. These are hard decisions, and people need time to figure them out, and they need support from staff. So you see, if people engage for months and months, like Jeff, they build up those capacities and can make really good decisions.
All right, we've got time for a call from Christine in Eau Claire. Christine, hi, you're on the air.
Well, it's very curious that your guest is talking about fun in democracy. I certainly have learned a lot as last October, I started getting involved in opposing a divisive project in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And what I learned very quickly is that although you have a right as a citizen to voice your concerns, the city council doesn't necessarily listen or hear you. And it's been particularly frustrating to try and speak the truth into some of the situations, trying to have the truth be heard, but the council, not everybody on the council, but the majority of the council not wanting to listen to it. So it's very different than I thought it would be. I thought there would be more of an acceptance of ideas, but not necessarily in this situation.
Gotcha. Christine, thank you so much for calling. I know one concern people have raised, Josh, with the idea of bringing game ideas into decision-making is that somebody can design it and stack the deck. But in some senses, Christine is saying, hey, maybe the stack is decked as things are anyway.
Exactly. I mean, the process is pretty broken now. If you think of most meetings where you get up and have 3 minutes at a mic in the front of the room and sit back down and to pray to people saying a few words, sitting down, and nothing really happening as a result. And that's immensely disempowering, and that leaves people really frustrated where they get involved because they want to make a difference. And the system is so broken that they leave and don't want to come back. And so that's the default. That's the status quo, is a very broken system where it's a rigged game and people can't make a difference. So there is that danger, of course, if you have a game of, you know, it can be rigged, but we already have that now. So I think if we can engage more people in redesigning those meetings so it's not just 3 minutes at the front of the room at a mic, then there's a lot more potential for people to actually play the game and win.
Since you've released this book and, of course, working on the participatory budgeting project, are you seeing more people interested in this idea, maybe starting to put it into practice around the U.S.?
Yeah, I am. There's some very great work happening. So there's some groups such as the Engagement Lab in Boston that's designing games for participatory planning for getting folks engaged in Chinatown and elsewhere there. Participatory budgeting is certainly taking off across the country with around 40 different cities or districts or institutions doing it this year. And I think what folks are recognizing is that we need to update government, that the old systems aren't working very well. People expect more now. They expect ways to be meaningfully engaged, and they're not going to just show up if you don't give them a real chance to have a say. And so people are experimenting with new ideas and finding ways to design experiences that are more pleasurable for city officials, for staff, for folks in the community, and that actually work better.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Josh Lerner. He's executive director of the Participatory Budgeting Project. His new book is called Making Democracy Fun: How Game Design Can Engage Citizens and Transform Politics.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our Curious Wisconsin segment. This week, we'll talk to a Washington Island resident about a modern Wisconsin incarnation of a classic European tradition, the stave church.
First, Wisconsin's Office of the Commissioner of Insurance announced this week that it would no longer enforce the state's contraception coverage mandate for employers with religious objections.
The commissioner pointed to last month's Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision that excused that company from complying with a federal mandate to provide contraception coverage. Wisconsin has a state-specific law that requires companies to cover contraception, but the commissioner has said the Supreme Court decision effectively negates it. Birth control advocates in the state disagree, and legal expert Marcy Hamilton wrote a column today arguing against the commissioner's decision.
Marcy Hamilton is the chair of public law at the Yeshiva School of Law. Her forthcoming book is called God Versus the Gavel: The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you make of the Walker administration's decision to stop requiring insurers to cover contraception based on this recent Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision?
Well, it's both an unconstitutional and misguided decision. It's very odd to see a state abandoning its own law for a case that only involved a federal statute that applies to federal law.
So why do you believe that is the case here in Wisconsin, that a Republican-controlled legislature, the Walker administration, I should say, has decided to make this move and follow a federal law instead of sticking with the state version?
Well, the federal law is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which only applies to federal laws. And what happened in Hobby Lobby is that it was used to undercut women's access to health care. But the federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, cannot be applied to state law, and that's because of a case that I actually had at the Supreme Court in 1997, where I represented the city of Boerne, Texas, and the Supreme Court held that RFRA may not be applied to state law. So it is simply unconstitutional for the state to now say they can't enforce their contraception mandate because of this federal RFRA.
How common are state-specific laws requiring companies to cover contraception around the country?
There are about 30 states that have such a requirement, and in those states, the Hobby Lobby decision should have no impact whatsoever. Now, some states do have their own state-level RFRAs, but Wisconsin's not one of them. It's been proposed several times, but the Wisconsin legislature has never enacted a state-level RFRA. And so the law that was in place under state law for contraception before Hobby Lobby should be identical to the law that's being enforced today.
Are we seeing anything like this, though, in any of these other states, saying that they can no longer uphold the state laws in light of Hobby Lobby?
No, on this issue at least, Wisconsin is now in the vanguard. It is the first state that has tried to cut back on women's contraception access based on state law. And it's indefensible, and I would assume other states have at least read the relevant cases at the Supreme Court to know that they can't do it.
Now, a spokesperson for Wisconsin's Office of Insurance has said that the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision means that Wisconsin can't enforce the law and that they actually have no choice in this matter. What do you make of that reasoning?
Well, it's just wrong. You know, sometimes lawyers are wrong, and here they're really wrong. As I said, he cannot use the Hobby Lobby decision, which is about federal RFRA applied to federal law, to undermine state law. And essentially what the Walker administration is doing here is they are overriding the Wisconsin state legislature's own statutes. There's no justification for it. And I assume that the people of Wisconsin and the legislature are going to be unhappy that their own law has been undermined, and it's unconstitutional to do that.
Is this perhaps a case of the Office of Insurance trying to get out ahead of the curve and saying, you know, we've already seen this Hobby Lobby decision, so the Wisconsin law will not hold up any longer. It will fall in court, so we're just going to start, you know, acting as such, being preemptive about it.
Well, there's nothing that could make it fall in court. The Supreme Court made it very clear that the decision interpreting RFRA was based on RFRA and that it is not what the First Amendment requires. Under Wisconsin state law, the state statute is perfectly constitutional. Under the federal constitution, it's perfectly constitutional. So for them to try to get out ahead of it is they're way ahead of themselves. And, you know, they're basically asking for costly federal litigation to find out that they should have read a 1997 decision at the United States Supreme Court.
Do you expect to see any states following suit?
Well, only states where there is a state RFRA. And what they'll do is they'll try to argue that their state RFRA should be interpreted just like the federal RFRA. That's a reach. It's a real stretch, but I would imagine they will. But for the states without a state RFRA, there's just no justification for this.
So if Wisconsin, say, wanted to exempt insurers from covering contraceptives, would you argue that the better path to choose would have been to establish a Wisconsin RFRA?
Well, a RFRA is never the better path. It is always a law that leads down paths that no one's ever imagined that end up harming other people. But if they would like to change the state law that governs whether or not women are going to have their contraception covered, then they should consider amending the state law. As I understand it, that was on the table introduced by the Republicans, but it's never been passed. So this was an end run around the political process that the Republicans had attempted to use to try to undermine access of contraception for women.
So what do you expect to happen at this point? This is a contentious move, and we have, you know, some groups, including Planned Parenthood and others, upset about this. What do you think will happen next? Are we going to see litigation?
Well, I would hope that the commissioner would save the Wisconsin taxpayers the dollars of federal litigation and retract its erroneous legal announcement. They're just wrong. But if they're going to persist in this incorrect interpretation of a federal case, then they're asking for litigation, and I would imagine they'll find it.
Are there other aspects of that Hobby Lobby ruling that could be applied to states and used to say that insurers in a state didn't have to cover contraception?
No. Only the standard that the court applies is this extreme standard established by the federal RFRA. So as I say, the only way that a state RFRA, that a state might mirror what the federal court did is by saying that their state RFRA has to be interpreted just like the federal RFRA. There's no requirement of that. That case is not binding on state RFRA interpretation, but they could certainly offer it as persuasive theory.
So given what you've said today, do you expect a lawsuit against the administration to be successful?
Well, you know, I think it's very unusual for a commissioner in a state to issue a ruling that is just flat wrong on the law, not revisit it, and withdraw it. If that doesn't happen, the citizens of Wisconsin can assume that this was actually politically motivated rather than a legal mistake. And in that circumstance, I would expect there would probably be litigation against it because it's unjustifiably denying women contraception, and it's basically a violation of the separation of powers under the Wisconsin Constitution.
Do you see any way in which that litigation would fail and that the state would prevail?
No, I don't. It would require a court to impose on the state of Wisconsin a standard that the state of Wisconsin has not chosen in its statutes. And that would be shocking.
Marcy, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Marcy Hamilton, the chair of public law at the Yeshiva School of Law. Her forthcoming book is called God Versus the Gavel, The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty.
Back in the Middle Ages, stave churches were quite common in Europe. A few of them remain today, mostly in Norway and Sweden. And in today's Curious Wisconsin, we find out there's at least one modern example here in the state.
It's Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church on Washington Island in Door County, and the Washington Island resident Richard Purinton was involved in its construction. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon, Veronica and Rob.
Well, let's find out what stave churches are. Can you describe one for us?
Well, they began, I think, at being posts and ground type construction. In some of the literature, they're called palisade-type churches. That was the forerunner of the current stave church. Obviously, burying a post, pine post or fir post or whatever in the soil meant that it would deteriorate rather quickly. Then they gradually evolved to placing stones in the holes, then laid stone foundations. And around the year 1000 to 1100, about the time that Norway received Christianity, they began to evolve from those posting ground type constructions to a more of a laid stone foundation, and that's the sort of a stave church we have here in Washington Island. Then from those stone foundations, pillars are erected, and it's an almost entirely wood construction.
And you said around the turn of the millennium there, 1000 to 1100 is when these became popular. Did they range mostly in Scandinavia or elsewhere too, do you know?
As far as I know, primarily Norway with a few in Sweden, although those in Sweden apparently were found to be outdated and they were replaced in later years. So there are only one or two examples left in Sweden. Some similar type construction was found in Denmark. I'm not sure if any currently exists there. And the post-and-ground type construction was found in other places, such as England, but almost all of those were replaced with stone or different types of structures later on, whereas those in Norway, the ones that survived, and there are about 30 of them today, are excellent examples of stave churches.
Why would? Why did they choose that material?
Well, I think primarily because they had a lot of wood. This was in valleys of Norway. These churches were built on prominent hills. I'm picturing these isolated fjords. They may not have been that way in all cases, but that's at least my mental image. Fairly isolated farming valleys, and each would have its own stave church. So somewhere in around 1,300 of these churches existed at one time, but through gradual deterioration down to just 29 or 30 today. But they were good woodworkers, I think, not only building watercraft of wood. They were good wood carvers, or became good wood carvers. And they had just had an abundance of wood. That was probably the easiest material for them to work with.
Before we get to the stave church that you helped build on Washington Island, did Norwegian immigrants bring those over to the United States and maybe Wisconsin say, there's a lot of wood here, this is a good opportunity to bring something from the old country?
As far as I know, they did not bring that style of construction with them. This is something of a much later time period where people are looking back maybe with some nostalgia and looking at the beauty of the existing stave churches in Norway and wanting to recreate that here. There are maybe 10 to a dozen examples that I'm aware of in the U.S., and I've only seen a few of those, and they're all more recently constructed, trying to emulate the old style.
And why did folks on Washington Island decide that they wanted to build one?
I'm not sure that everybody decided it was a great idea, but a pastor at the Trinity Lutheran Church in about the mid-1980s, I think his brother had worked on one in Minnesota. Anyway, he thought it would be a good way to honor Scandinavian heritage on Washington Island, and not everybody here has Norwegian heritage, and few people probably knew what he was referring to. So there was a little bit of a controversy over whether or not funds should be set aside for such a project. But once it was approved, surprisingly, a lot more funds came in. Pretty soon materials were purchased, and by 1991, a foundation was laid.
And how authentic did you all try to be in the construction of this? Did you really try to recreate a church from, you know, about 1,000 years ago?
Well, I think it was a process in which we tried to emulate and come as close as we could. There were no detailed blueprints, so an architect from Sister Bay, Pat Mangan, offered his services to provide some elevations, floor plan, and a material list, and he patterned it after a church in Borgund, Norway. It's not an exact replica, but it's patterned after that, so it has several of these tiers with what I guess I would refer to as dormers, kind of a cake-like layers to it. Verticality is stressed. And in the interior, there are 12 large posts, or you might even call them masts. Those are the staves, the 12 primary structural members of the building. And then the rest of the structure is erected around that. So it was about a three-year process for the construction until the building was dedicated.
What does it feel like to be inside this stave church on Washington Island?
Well, I've been in it many times, and I take tour groups probably 6 to 8 times a week around the island, and that's one of our stops. And I'm always observing people's reactions, and as we head down this path through the woods, some people haven't been paying attention, so they have no idea what it is we're going to see, and others have expectations that are maybe different than what they'll see. And they come out of the woods and see the structure, very very pretty, great proportions, kind of a softness to it, and an elegance, and they're overwhelmed by it.
Is it light wood or dark wood?
The wood is light to begin with, but it's been stained with a combination of pine tar and something like linseed oil. It isn't linseed oil, but it's close to that, so it's absorbed into the wood to provide a waterproofing, and that has to be reapplied every 5-6 years, otherwise the wood tends to dry out. Photographs that I've seen of the old stave churches that still exist in Norway had a much heavier application of pine tar, and that stuff, I like to equate it to the old-style telephone poles where the creosote kind of slumps down to the bottom of the pole over time. This is lighter, and it probably won't do that, but it does dry out in the sun after 5-6 years. It has to be reapplied.
Looking at it from the outside, does it really stand out? Is this all of a sudden you're coming out of the woods and there's this 1,000-year-old, just-converted Vikings sort of building in the middle of nowhere?
Yes, I mean, people really are surprised at it. And, you know, as they're coming down the path, some might say, what is it we're supposed to see again here? And they're a little bit bored and maybe restless, and like Americans are when they're on the vacation. And then they see this, and their mood changes. I invite them inside. It's always open to the public, night and day, year-round, for that matter. And after they've taken a few photos, ask them to please have a seat. There's only room for about 40 people inside. It's quite small. And then I tell them about the history of the church and the construction, and they seem to change during that period of time. Something, you know, it doesn't matter what their background or, you know, I see people from all over the world at these different things, and they all have an interest in what's going on there, and I think a general respect for the building and the construction.
And this is a functioning church, right? Are there actual services there?
Yes, there are. Wednesday evenings in the summer months, I think up to about mid-September, at 7:30 there are services.
Held in Norwegian?
No, they're in English. I don't know if you did it in Norwegian, if anyone would understand. They're in English, and you know they might have some guitar or similar instrument, but otherwise there's no church organ, no piano, you know, or a cappella. You know, someone will lead it, pastor of the Lutheran Church or others. But it is a Lutheran church, and then there are also weddings occasionally, but that wasn't really seen as the purpose of the church, partly because, as we found out, when there are weddings there, first of all, it puts it off limits to everyone else for that period of time. And then, secondly, it takes organization to make reservations, and their deposits and people change their minds, and it becomes a very commercial type of enterprise. So that was not entirely discouraged, but it's not played up.
Best just to drop in then, it sounds like.
It's open for visitation, meditation, and for people to appreciate it, but if they do wish to get married, they need to make that reservation in advance.
Gotcha. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Washington Island resident Richard Purinton.